Hello, I'm Andrew Kleiman, and this is episode 113 of Radio Free Humanity, the Marxist Humanist Podcast, coming to you from deep within capitalist society. The main segment of this episode is the conclusion of Francisco's interview with me, which we recorded on March 2nd, on my recent article, Marx's Critique of Dorimon in the Grundrisse. The article is about one of Marx's most in-depth critiques of Proudhonism, the doctrines of Pierre-Joseph Proudhon. Alfred Dorimon was a major follower of and secretary to Proudhon, and the Grundrisse, which Marx wrote in 1857 and 1858, starts off with a 60-page critique of Dorimon's book on banking reform. In the second half of the interview, which you'll be listening to today, Francisco and I talk about a couple of key themes in Marx's critique of Dorimon: labor money, also known as time chits, and indirectly social labor versus directly social labor. This is the text where Marx first works out the distinction between directly and indirectly social labor. In the first half of the interview, in episode 112, Francisco and I talked about what Proudhonism was, why it was concerning to Marx, why he fought it. We also talked about the overriding issue in the critique of Dorimon: what is possible in a capitalist society and what's not? In what ways and to what extent can it be different from what it currently is? But first up, in this episode's current events segment, Gabriel Donnelly and I discussed Chuck Schumer's March 14 speech on Israel and Palestine. Schumer is the Senate Majority Leader in the U.S., and he told BB to go bye-bye. Please visit MarxistHumanistInitiative.org, the website of Marxist Humanist Initiative, to listen to past episodes of this podcast series, to learn more about the issues discussed in them, to post comments, and to donate to this podcast series. We really need donations. Radio Free Humanity is sponsored and hosted by Marxist Humanist Initiative, but the views expressed by hosts and guests are our own. They don't necessarily reflect the views or positions of MHI. On Sunday, March 7, 1 to 3 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time in the U.S., 6 to 8 p.m. British Summer Time, MHI will be holding a Zoom meeting on the state of the U.S. economy in the year of the general elections. It's open to the public. If you'd like to attend, please write to MHI and ask to be invited. Next up will be Gabriel Donnelly and I discussing Schumer's March 14 speech on Israel and Palestine. Hi, this is Andrew, and I'm here with Gabriel Donnelly, my co-host. This is Sunday, March 17, 2024. We'll be talking about Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer's speech on Thursday, 3 days ago. That was a big deal. He basically said that there needs to be a two-state solution in Israel-Palestine, that Netanyahu has got to go, that he's an obstacle to peace. And this was bombshell talk in the opinion of a great many people, because Schumer has been a longtime supporter of Israel. And even during this speech, he stressed that he's still supporting Israel, but he was making a clear distinction between Israel and Netanyahu. What was your take on this speech?
Yeah, it was both a surprise and then not a surprise, because it's part of a bit of a trend we've been seeing on a higher than even a senator level the past few weeks between Paris and DC and other voices that are usually fully in support of the Israeli government coming down a little harder than one might expect on Netanyahu and his crew of right-wing strongmen.
There seems to be a very concerted, very massive push by Biden and all kinds of people close to him, like Schumer, like the Netanyahu government is intransigent. We got to get rid of them. They're not paying attention to us. They're not doing anything we say. They're not going to. And we know why they're not going to, because it's just like with Donald Trump. Nobody is going to compromise when compromising means that they're going to be landing in prison.
Netanyahu materially benefits from the continuing of the war because the war maintains his rickety government governing coalition that always seems to be threatening to collapse, but no one wants to truly collapse it and move to election because no one wants to have an election during wartime. He materially benefits in the sense that he's not behind bars or not under serious corruption investigations, which he's running from while the war goes on.
One of the things that amazed me most was Schumer was incredibly explicit in so many ways. Schumer said there's four major obstacles to the two-state solution. One is Hamas and Palestinians who support and tolerate their evil ways. Second, radical right-wing Israelis. And he name-checked both Smotrich and Ben-Gvir as part of that. Then he said Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas. Abbas has got to go. And finally, Netanyahu. And he went into detail about why basically all of them got to be done away with in one way, shape, or form. He says that Netanyahu has lost his way by allowing his political survival to take precedence. He called out Netanyahu's attempts to co-opt the judiciary. And what I thought was most interesting is he says, if Netanyahu's current coalition remains in power after the war begins to wind down and continues to pursue dangerous and inflammatory policies, then the United States will have no choice but to play a more active role in shaping Israeli policy by using our leverage to change the present course. It's like, Israelis, you got to get rid of this guy. He's got to go. This is not negotiable. If you don't do this, this is the price that you're going to pay. We're going to step in and we're going to tell you, here's the way it is.
Perspectives have to be changed and people need to really, really reconsider how they're thinking about everything to construct peace. And that's going to take a lot of work, but it can be done. It can be done, but there needs to be people willing to do that. And the Netanyahu government has shown that they are not willing to in any way change. They're materially incentivized against changing, and that they're just not interested in it. Many of them are proto-fascist or near explicitly fascistic far-right forces. The potential for a changing, lasting peace, it has to be now, because we've seen since October 7th tens of thousands of civilian deaths, and the way in which Netanyahu's government is conducting this war and looking towards the post-war future is repeating the exact same mistakes and methodologies. Israeli far-right forces have empowered figures like Abbas and Hamas and allowed their corruption to flourish in Palestinian areas because it makes the whole population more manageable. When you have these basically warlords who have control over the distribution of supplies, as opposed to a truly empowered mass population, that it's these fiefdoms controlled by warlords who distribute supplies and control the whole area. And then you're only dealing with one force instead of several, and it makes the whole thing more manageable. It's a good thing to hear that someone as important as Schumer, some noises from the Biden administration itself, although nothing as strong, disgusting and disgraceful that it took this long.
Yeah, and it took the events in Michigan, the uncommitted vote, and the prospect of losing Michigan in the upcoming election, and people even saying, well, yeah, we know Trump is even worse, but we've had it. We're going to let him be president for another 4 years. We don't care. I mean, that's really scary, because if Trump gets back into office, that's going to be it for Palestinians, other Arabs, other Muslims in this country, Jews, and it's not going to be, we were able to tough it out for the first 4 years, we can do it for the second 4 years. I mean, everybody knows it's not going to be tolerable. I mean, Trump is threatening, mass deportations already.
The Likud headquarters has a picture of Trump still up on the wall, And, you know, the party overwhelmingly, Netanyahu's party overwhelmingly is hoping for a Trump re-election and cheering him on from afar. The struggle against Trumpism is a struggle against far-right forces everywhere, or it's nothing at all. And these are, you know, make no mistake about it, Netanyahu and his crew are Trumpist forces in action and in alliance. And they have to go. Schumer's speech is barely a start, but it's good to see some a little bit of sense being said about this.
I don't have a lot of hope for even a two-state solution, so-called bringing peace. But what we have seen starting October 7 and then for months and months and months now is not just even an issue of peace. It's an issue of stopping the wanton slaughter of civilians. I want to make clear that what Schumer is calling for is obviously not acceptable to Palestinians, because his two-state solution that he's calling a two-state solution is for, first of all, a demilitarized Palestinian state. And he also says that the insistence on an unequivocal right of return is a fatal impediment to progress. So that's a little bit, you know, politician talk. What is an unequivocal right of return? God knows, right? The other thing that I thought was really interesting about all of this was AIPAC, the main pro-Israel lobby group in the U.S.
Yeah.
Their response was really, really muted. They didn't come out and condemn Schumer's speech. They didn't say we disagree with it even. Whereas like the liberal Jewish lobbying organization, J Street, they were like totally effusive, like this is a new beginning.
Want to help regular conservatives. I mean, maybe this is why AIPAC was kind of muted. They've seen the writing on the wall that the far right doesn't actually do them any favors at all, and they need a quote-unquote sensible conservative Israeli government.
My question is whether the United States has the ability to really do anything in this situation. It could send troops to try to topple the Israeli government. Even if it were to withhold aid, I don't know that would force Netanyahu out.
Yeah, I saw something a little while ago, and I read somewhere that Biden had apparently been telling people in private that to withhold aid wouldn't do anything to stop it, because there's more than enough military supplies and material and budget stockpiled, and it would just be a, I suppose, a PR move. And he doesn't know if he wants to do that, if it doesn't have the result of actually having an impact on the Netanyahu government. Perhaps he worries it might embolden them.
Benny Gantz, you know, a challenger to Netanyahu, who would probably become the next prime minister if they had an election in Israel. He was in Washington recently. He was critical of Schumer's speech. That's where I'm keeping my eye on what is going on with Benny Gantz, and secondly with Yair Lapid, who's the other kind of like centrist political figure, big name in Israel. Lapid was favorably disposed to the Schumer speech.
Okay, so now let's just skip to the section on labor money that you have in your article. Marx's critique of Dairyman abandons the strategy of responding to his arguments against the metallic standard point by point, and then instead jumps to attacking Proudhonists head on the subject of labor money. Why does he do that? Why is that important?
Right. I think it's important for two reasons. First of all, Marx isn't getting anywhere when he's doing this point by point critique of Dairyman's book. 20 pages on the metallic standard, on the assets of the Bank of France, on just all these particular things that Dairyman's taken up. None of it is on what Marx has already said is the fundamental question, whether getting off of the metallic standard would do away with monetary crises as such and all of the attendant problems, which is what the Proudhonists were assuming, or whether these problems would just reappear in a different form with a different kind of money regime. Dairyman is not addressing that at all, and by going down the rabbit hole with him point by point, Marx is also not getting to the question at all. He's not even getting any closer to it. So Marx changes course. He says, the hell with this. Let's tackle the essential question. Would any monetary regime whatsoever solve the problem of monetary crises? So after about 20 pages in this critique of Dariamon, what Dariamon actually says in his book, it does a disappearing act after about 20 pages in. And Marx begins to talk about what money is, what money has to be, what's unavoidable once you have money, why money is unavoidable itself. And he focuses mostly on labor money. Now he's saying, basically, there's no alternative kind of money system that's going to do what Dariamon wants, etc. There's no monetary system that can avoid monetary crises and all of the problems associated with it. But he focuses on labor money, just one kind of money, you know, not anything we've ever seen. And he does that even though Proudhon, Dariamon never come out explicitly and say, we want a system of labor money. So why is he pursuing a critique of them on the basis of labor money when that's not what they themselves called for? And he's supposedly talking about, here are the problems inherent in all kinds of money and they're unavoidable. I think the answer is that labor money is the strongest case. By tackling the issue of labor money, Marx is confronting all of his opponents, the monetary reformers, at their strongest point. If any kind of money system could accomplish what the monetary reformers want, labor money would be the system that would do it. If Marx can show the opposite, that even a labor money system wouldn't solve the problems that the monetary reformers want solved, he's basically showing that no other monetary reform could do so either.
What did Proudhonists argue against metallic money? What do they promise their ideas would accomplish? And what does Marx's answer to that?
Yeah, I'm going to give a somewhat simplified answer because a longer answer is just too much here. One thing that the Proudhonists wanted to do was to solve the problem that during economic downturns, recessions and stuff, prices fall. Prices in terms of gold or silver fall. And they thought that getting off of the metallic standard would stop the declines in prices. And why did they want to get rid of falling prices? I mean, consumers like that, right? Well, they were concerned with small producers, small farmers, craftspeople, small merchants. And when prices fall, that's the prices they're charging, their income falls. And with lower income, they got debts they can't repay, that are harder to repay, and so forth. Okay, so Marx is looking at this. They don't want the prices to fall. And Marx says, well, look, this is only one half of the situation. There are also economic upturns where prices rise. So the general issue, what goes up must come down, what goes down must come up, the general issue is that prices fluctuate. And so the question is, can a different money system eliminate price fluctuations? And if the price fluctuations were eliminated, that would eliminate the ups and downs in the economy. Excuse me, it would mean that the ups and downs in the economy have been eliminated. If the upturns and downturns are the periods in which the prices rise and fall, and they don't rise and fall, then you're not going to have the upturns and downturns either. Now, the Proudhonists said that, put in Marx's terminology, the problem of fluctuating prices is a problem of price differing from value. If a thing's price rises, it rises above the thing's value or average price. Conversely, if the price falls, it's a fall below value or average price. So if we could ensure that the thing's price always equals its value, we could get rid of price fluctuations. And if there's any kind of monetary system that could eliminate the differences between price and value, labor money would be that system. You labor for 8 hours, you produce a commodity, it's worth 8 hours of labor money. You sell the commodity to a central bank, you get an 8-hour banknote in return. So it seems that the price of the commodity just has to equal the value. The amount of labor it's worth is the amount of labor you performed. Marx shows that that's completely false. It's too complex for me to explain here how he showed it, but you can read his critique. It's in his critique of Dorimon, and I discuss it in my article. The upshot is that prices would continue to fluctuate even in a labor money system, and no monetary system can eliminate price fluctuations.
Is that the illusory assumption that the Proudhonists make?
Yeah, it's actually connected. It's a good way of talking about the underlying intuition that's driving that argument of Marx. We can't go into the ins and outs, but the underlying intuition about why prices would still fluctuate has to do with Marx saying, look, there's two different kinds of differences between price and value. One is that a thing's price expresses or measures its worth in terms of money, not in terms of labor. That's one price value difference. But the other is quantitative. Prices and values differ quantitatively. What a thing's worth in the market isn't identical to its cost of production. And the illusory assumption that he's referring to, made by Proudhonists and proponents of labor money, is that by eliminating the first difference, in other words, by starting to express price in terms of labor, they would eliminate the second difference, the quantitative one. And then if you eliminate the quantitative difference, you're eliminating price fluctuating around value. And what Marx shows is that eliminating the first difference doesn't eliminate the quantitative difference. The illusory assumption is that it would.
So at the end of this section on labor money, you quote Marx stating that the bank would either be a despotic ruler of production and trustee of distribution, or it would merely be a board which keeps the books and accounts for a society producing in common. What does that have to do with Proudhon and this discussion?
Well, it doesn't have anything directly to do with the Proudhon and the Exchange Bank and the Dorimon and so forth, but it has to do with this labor money issue. Part of John Gray's labor money proposal is that everything would work through a central bank. So Marx begins finally to discuss how the central bank is meant to function and how it would actually have to function. Gray is imagining a society in which there are independent commodity producers, they exchange with one another, and it all works through this bank. They sell their commodities to the bank, get labor money, use the labor money to purchase other commodities. So it's basically an idea that we can retain this independent producer thing, production of commodities, with labor money. And the kind of ironic thing that you quote as Marx's conclusion is what he's saying is, it's actually not compatible at all with this independent commodity production. What you would either have is basically state capitalist despotism, or you'd have a free society, you know, of communal producers, and this bank would just be like a bookkeeping or accounting agency. And his point, how he gets to this conclusion, is what would the bank have to do? Nobody is going to take a labor money certificate or time shit, unless they were confident that they could take that piece of paper and get other things that they want or need. So the bank would have to be the guarantor of this. The bank would have to make it possible that when you hand over your commodity to the bank, there will be stuff, a sufficient supply of other stuff. So he says, look, this bank would have to be the buyer of everything and the seller of everything, and to make sure that the stuff was there in the right proportions, it would have to regulate production. And, you know, when you think about it, it'd be either a despotic ruler of production and guarantor of distribution, or else it would just be this bookkeeping agency for a communal communist society.
So now going on to the next section on directly social labor and keeping close with this idea of possibility, we go into Marx's critique, where he says that alternative forms of money cannot accomplish what is demanded of them without suspending the very relation of production, which is expressed in the category money. Let's break that down a little bit. Can you explain the relationship between the mode of production and money in terms of which one determines which, sort of like an order of determination, and relate this to the concept of expression that Marx uses here?
I think what he's trying to say is that there's a certain relation of production, and it requires that there be money. Money exists because this relation of production exists. Money arises on the basis of it and corresponds to it, or as he says, expresses it. In other words, money is a manifestation of this underlying social relation.
And what is the relation of production that, in his view, money expresses, the relation that must be abolished?
Right. When he says suspended, that's, I think, a poor translation into the English. I think it should be abolished. Without abolishing the very relation of production that's expressed in the category money. Anyway, the relation of production I think he's referring to is the indirectly social character of labor in a system of commodity production. Why doesn't he say it like that? Well, I don't think he's developed the wording or maybe even a clear conception at that point. But the idea is in commodity production, you do some work. That act of labor doesn't immediately qualify as an act of social labor. It will qualify as social labor if it creates value and only to the extent that it creates value. In my article, I make a prima facie case for this interpretation of what he means by the very relation of production that's expressed in the category money.
And you agree that it is within this critique of Dairyman that Marx first develops the concept of directly social labor and its opposite. Can you tell us what Marx writes here?
Right before getting to this, the way he moves into this is he talks about the social connections between persons in a commodity-producing society. He says the social connection between persons is they're transformed into a social relations between things. Says that in the fetishism section in chapter one of Capital later. What are these social relations between things? They're exchange relations between products, but they're not direct product-to-product relations. There's not barter. Rather, there's a network of indirect exchange relations. And it's all held together by money. But why is that? Marx eventually arrives at the conclusion that this network of exchange relations has to be indirect because the products aren't directly social. Only money is directly social, not the other commodities. And the products aren't directly social because the labor that produces these products isn't directly social. It doesn't qualify as an act of social labor unless it creates value. So maybe it would help to explain why or in what sense the products are not directly social. All commodities have in common is that they're things of value. That's their common property. That's their social existence. You know, as physical things, as use values, they're all different from one another. But money in exchange relations counts directly as value. The other commodities count as value only insofar as they are exchangeable with money. The moment they can't exchange with money, they lose value. So you've got $100. Well, how much value do you have? Well, I just told you it's $100, right? The physical thing, the 100 bills or whatever, that physical thing seems to be value itself. The thing itself is directly social. The other things that it exchanges with, or the other things exchange with it, they seem to acquire their social character of being value by virtue of, and only insofar as they are exchangeable with it. That's the indirectly social character of the other commodities, and Marx is saying something similar is going on with the labor. It is social labor. I mean, we're producing for each other, but not directly. Our labor counts as social labor, qualifies as social labor only to the extent that it is creating this value.
That's interesting. I didn't actually know that. And you argue that this prefigures the critique of the Goethe program as well?
Oh, let me just quote. Marx writes, we've got the capitalist society and we've got this new society. So he's directly talking about the new society, but Listen to the contrasts with capitalist society. He writes, within the collective society based on common ownership of the means of production, the producers do not exchange their products. Just as little does the labor employed on the products appear here as the value of these products. Since now, individual labor no longer exists in an indirect fashion, but directly as a component part of total labor. And then he spends a long time developing the implications of directly social labor and how its implications differ drastically from the implications of indirectly social labor.
You also mentioned the importance of, I guess, one of my favorite segments ever written by Marx, which is the section on the method of political economy. Can you talk a little bit about that section and why you bring it up in your article?
If you look at the Critique of Dariamon, there is the terminology of directly social labor, indirectly social labor. That terminology is kind of there, but mostly Marx is using words like directly general, indirectly general, with regard to both the labor and the products, and it amounts to the same thing. But there's a slightly different connotation. Among commodities, money is directly general. Other commodities aren't. Money is exchangeable with everything and the equivalent of everything. The other commodities aren't, not directly. So this is why Marx is using this directly general, indirectly general language in connection with labor. He's basically seeing that what's there in the money commodity relation is there in the character of the labor. And he's getting to the social character of labor being indirect through an inquiry into money, analogizing it to the relation of commodities and money. So when he uses the terms directly general and indirectly general, those kinds of formulations bear the mark of their origin in this inquiry into money. And there's a danger at that point. Since Marx is deriving the character of the labor from the money, that can make it seem that money is the cause and the indirectly general character of labor is the effect. Or putting it in reverse, it could make it seem that if you get rid of money, then you also cause labor to become directly general. But in Marx's view, it's the opposite. The character of the labor is the cause, and money or absence of money is the effect. At this point, it occurred to me, okay, Marx talks about exactly this in the introduction to the Grundrisse. Here's what he says. He says, the concrete appears in the process of thinking as a result, not as a point of departure, even though it is the point of departure in reality. This method of rising from the abstract to the concrete, it's only the way in which thought appropriates the concrete, reproduces it as the concrete in the mind. But this is by no means the process by which the concrete itself comes into being. That's exactly what's going on with indirectly social labor and money here. In the real world, the indirectly social character of labor is the concrete. It's the point of departure. Money, that's the abstraction, that's the result. But in Marx's thought process, the indirectly social labor was a result derived from an inquiry into money. So moving from money to indirectly social labor, from the abstract to the concrete, is the way his thinking appropriated the concrete. But it's not how the concrete, indirectly social labor itself comes into being. So I wanted to clarify that.
Does that have anything to do with history or the logical order of ideas?
Well, it has to do with history because we're talking at that point then about how indirectly social labor comes into being.
And how does it come into being?
He works this out in the Critique of Dariamon. And later, he's got the same thing in the fetishism section in chapter one of Capital. So prior to capitalism, you've got what he calls relations of personal dependence or personal subordination. Some people are subordinate to other people, slaves subordinate to masters, and so forth. You get rid of slavery, the serfs get their freedom, and it looks like dependence is a thing of the past. And there is no personal dependence. Everybody is formally free in commodity producing society and capitalism and so forth. So Marx says, yeah, okay, we've got this personal independence now in capitalism, but this personal independence is founded on relations of objective dependence. And you read further, and what he means by objective dependence is dependence on objects, subordination of people to things. And that's the fetish. Things have power and people don't, or they have power only through the things. You have power because your power is, you carry it around in your pocket, money.
So money has power over the bank, not the bank has power over money.
Absolutely. So, how does indirectly social labor come into being? Well, it comes into being because we have a big wide network in which everybody is working for society, for one another, but it's not direct. We don't have people-to-people relations. All of this is mediated through this system of exchange in which money rules the roost.
And does that have anything to do with the concept of alienation?
Yes, he says, if people are under the domination of these things confront them as an alien power over which they've got no control. It, in fact, controls them. And he says, even people's labor confronts them as something alien to them.
Is there a specific moment in history that explains how that power of things over people comes to being?
Well, I think only in the following sense. Commodity relations develop more and more, commodity exchange, as feudalism kind of begins to break down and so forth. You get more trade, greater extension of trade between this region and that region. But it's all limited by the fact that still in Europe, the vast bulk of the people live on the land. They've got ties to the land. The landowners can't kick off the serfs and put up a resort and call it Mar-a-Lago and shit like that. So there are all these ties. And so you're not going to get a system where everything that you get through exchange rather than producing for yourself and your family and so forth. A full development of a system of exchange where exchange is the universal way of getting everything. That's only going to come about when people no longer have ties to the land. They're no longer producing for themselves. And why aren't they producing for themselves any longer? Well, historically, this is the so-called primitive accumulation. This is the enclosures of land in England, the forcing of peasants off the land. Now they got no way of making a living. They've got no means of production of their own. Even means of production like land that they would be renting from landlords and so forth. So, what happens? They become proletarians. They got to get hold of money to acquire anything. And their own ability to work, labor power, that becomes a commodity too. So, it's a whole new epoch that gets created.
And where can we find the segment on primitive accumulation?
The whole last section of Volume One of Capital deals with it. It's not in the Critique of Daima.
In your article, you mentioned that toward the end of his critique of Daimon, Marx brings in two passages from Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations, and you argue that he arrives at this idea of directly social labor and indirectly social labor by engaging with these passages from Smith. What is it that Smith says, and how does this relate to directly social labor?
Yeah, so Marx is kind of spinning his wheels talking about this relation to dependence and independence, and he goes on and on and on. He's not talking about labor yet. And then, kind of like he stumbles by accident into something that causes him to mention labor. And then he recalls something Adam Smith says. I think it's the following. At the start, second paragraph of chapter 5 of book 1 of Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations, Smith writes, labor was the first price, the original purchase money that was paid for all things. It was not by gold or by silver, but by labor that all the wealth of the world was originally purchased. That's a metaphor. What Smith is basically getting at is production of something costs workers their labor. Labor is what they give up in order to produce it. So the references to money and purchase, they're metaphorical. But Marx takes that, and shortly thereafter, he says, Smith also says the following, and he gives it a really creative interpretation. But here's what Smith said, I think that Marx is referring to. He doesn't quote it, so it's not 100% clear, but I think this is from the first paragraph of chapter four of Book One of the Wealth of Nations. Smith writes, "It's just a very small part of a man's wants which the produce of his own labor can supply. He supplies the far greater part of them by exchanging that surplus part of the produce of his own labor, which is over and above his own consumption, for such parts of the produce of other men's labor as he has occasion for." So he's basically saying people produce partly for their own consumption, and they produce partly to get things that they can exchange and then get money and buy other things. These two things, remember from Smith, get Marx eventually to the concept of indirectly and directly social labor.
So you close this last section with a quote by Marx explaining how the product of labor is not an exchange value. I'm going to read it to you. Maybe you can walk us through it. It's the last paragraph before the conclusion. Making this argument, Marx also refers back to his earlier discussion of the three successive forms of society, contrasting the character of labor in commodity-producing society to its character in a society producing in common, in which free individuality prevails. In the latter society, the communal character of production would make the product into a communal, general product from the outset. And what would hold true for the product would also hold true for the labor that produces it. Labor would be posited as general before exchange. That is, the exchange of products would in no way be the medium by which the participation of the individual in general production is mediated. Since in this case, the labor of the individual is posited from the outset as social labor, he or she has no particular product to exchange. His product is not an exchange value. What does that mean? How do you explain that?
Here's what I think he's saying in different terms. He's now thinking of a free communist society, not state capitalism, a society that produces communally. In such a society, the producers labor and the products that they produce, they're social from the outset. So you're working as part of society. What you produce doesn't belong to you, it's part of society's total production. It belongs to everybody. So your labor is social from the outset, or directly social. The products are social from the outset, directly social. What's that imply? Clearly, the producers don't exchange products with one another. That doesn't even make any sense because they don't own the products as individuals in the first place. And that means, furthermore, that the products are not values. They're just products. When you talk about something being a value, you're really saying it's got this thing in common with other things such that it can exchange with them. Well, no, that's not happening. And since there's no exchange of products and there's no value character to the products, they're just products for consumption and for making the society grow and whatever. Products are products. We like them because they have good properties for us. They're use values. They're not exchange values. They're not values. So there's no money either. Conversely, you can run it all backwards. The existence of money, that implies that the products are values and that the producers exchange them and that production is not communal. And that the products and the labor are not directly social from the outset. So, indirectly social labor, that's this relation of production that is made manifest by money.
And so saying that $100 equals $100 makes no sense anymore.
There won't be any dollars. There won't be $100.
But you wouldn't be able to calculate the value of $100 anymore because you wouldn't be able to exchange it with anything.
There won't be a value in that sense to anything. It'll be what it is physically, and it won't have some additional social property that doesn't get confirmed by society unless it exchanges with the money. None of that's going to be the case. Things are going to be produced to satisfy our needs and our wants and the development of ourselves and our communities. Nothing is going to be produced for the purpose of exchanging it. And nothing's going to have this value in addition to this value and use.
So let me ask you a question that a lot of people might be wondering about. I myself, I know I had some trouble understanding it. This is a long question, so bear with me. You've mentioned directly social labor instead of indirectly social labor. And in your article from September 14 of 2022 on Marx's critique of the Gotha Program, you say that Marx talks about labor money, critiques it, says that it's impossible. But then when he talks about the lower face of communist production, he says that there is directly social labor. And he also says that when workers go get their goods, they are going to use certificates that equal a certain amount of labor. This sounds a lot like the timeshifts that Marx is critiquing here. What is the difference? Like, is Marx falling into a contradiction here? If you want, let me quote what you wrote back then. It's just two paragraphs. You wrote, "However, what may look like yet another labor money scheme rests on an economic foundation that is entirely alien to them. The proposals Marx criticized were intended to institute equal exchange in a society in which labor was only indirectly social, and in which production and exchange of values were therefore dominant. In contrast, this discussion of labor certificates pertains to a different kind of society in which labor is directly social and value relations have therefore been eliminated. In Marx's view, these differences made his discussion of labor certificates completely different from the proposals he had criticized as unviable. Owing to the revolutionary transformation of the economic foundation, exchange relations that were not viable in a commodity-producing society have become so."
You don't need to have a certificate that you did this and that much work. Nowadays, we could do the whole thing electronically. So imagine that you have it done electronically. You do 8 hours of work. So in some online file, there's your name, there's 8 hours next to it. You've done 8 hours work. You want to acquire something that has taken 2 hours work, then there's a entry alongside that, 8 hours down to 6 hours. There's no certificate, but it works the same way. There's clearly no money here. I can't even like say, here's the sense in which there's no money. There's no sense in which there's any money operating here. There's no exchange operating here, at least no exchange of products with anybody. You're involved in this big system, communal production, and you're doing labor for other people, and they're doing labor for you, and you're getting what they produce, and they're getting what you produce. So there's an exchange of labor for labor, but you're not exchanging products in any way, shape, or form like we do now. So there's no exchange of products, there's no money, labor money, or whatever money. It's just you do an amount of work, and because your labor directly qualifies as social, your doing of labor qualifies as labor, and it entitles you to withdraw an equivalent amount of labor or products that cost an equivalent amount of labor. And that's it.
Right. And maybe just to understand or clarify even further, instead of maybe electronically, you could also think of it with paper. But if it was paper, once you submit your certificate, the warehouse or the bank or whatever would be able to just take that paper and burn it, unlike money.
It wouldn't have any function anymore. It's just an indication that you're entitled to this much stuff. You get that much stuff, that piece of paper has no use anymore. You might as well throw it away, burn it, wrap fish in it, as we used to say.
There's not going to be any crisis like, oh no, we're out of certificates.
I don't know. I'm happy to let the new society's version of Ticketmaster deal with issues like that. But yeah, actually, let me talk about this idea of theater tickets, because one place in Capital, Marx says that what Robert Owen, another kind of utopian socialist, was talking about is no more labor money than a theater ticket is. So you can think of what Marx is talking about as certificates. They're like theater tickets. But actually, with a theater ticket, you can stand in front of the theater or the concert or whatever, you could sell it again. But you wouldn't be doing that with these certificates that Marx is talking about, the Critique of the Gotha program. So a lot of time people get fixated on, oh, what are the properties of these certificates? As if we get the properties of the certificates right, that's the key to the new society. Well, ownership is not going to be transferable. And people say, oh, and they're going to have a limited time. This certificate is only good through the end of March or whatever it might be. This is all kind of secondary in my view. So let me make an analogy. Let's say that I ask you, people pay to attend the theater. How are they able to attend the theater? If you say, well, the way they're able to attend the theater is they get a ticket and then they go up to the window and they fork over the ticket, they surrender the ticket, and then they're able to enter the theater. I mean, that's a kind of an explanation, but it doesn't go to the heart of the matter. The heart of the matter is people who pay for a ticket are able to attend because the payment entitles them to enter the theater. That's the economic explanation. And that's really what's going on. In the same way, if I ask you, how will people who do 8 hours of labor be able to acquire products that cost 8 hours of labor to produce? If somebody starts to tell me it's because they acquire certificates and they surrender certificates, and here's what you can and can't do with the certificates, that's an explanation of a sort, but it's superficial. What's really going on is that in a communal society, working entitles you to get products that cost the same amount of labor, in the same way that payment now entitles you to go into the theater. That's the economic content of what's going on. Payment now entitles, what it will be is working entitles.
And we wouldn't be a ticket-producing society.
Maybe we'll have tickets, but electronic accounting is good. This is not an economic issue. This is a Ticketmaster issue.
I guess just to close our discussion, I want to go back to what myself I thought was mostly the main point, because yeah, this timesheet and labor certificate discussion is important, but it seems like to me that the whole thing is really about this realistic outlook of Marx. And I was wondering if you could tell us why you discuss his realistic outlook in your conclusion.
What Marx talks about as the realistic outlook is being realistic about what's possible, what's not possible, when these things become possible, or more precisely, what changes in the relations of production would make possible the, quote, fair distribution that the Gotha program calls for, the abolition of money, the abolition of price fluctuations, et cetera, et cetera. He's saying you need new relations of production that alone makes all the rest of this possible. It's not possible without that. This is the realistic outlook. And he's saying, you guys are going to throw this all away so that you can unite with these LaSallian jokers? No thanks. I'm not going to have anything to do with your program or this unification. So in that sense, this reference to realistic outlook has everything to do with the whole of the paper and all of Marx's critiques of proudhonism and everything else. And because of that, I come back to it in the conclusion and I say, yeah, this is all really well and good, but we all know that there's a different kind of realism as well when it comes to politics. There's what Marx meant by the realistic outlook, and then there's the realism of doing what seems to be politically advantageous. Well, you got to be realistic. You got to build the left. You got to do whatever the hell they want you to do. And it's this latter kind of realism that a wide swath of the radical movement has always found appealing. So Marx was just not able to persuade other people to base their political commitments on what he said is and isn't possible. And that's even when they agreed with his ideas, their politics were not based on that, based more on what seems politically advantageous. So the unification at Gotha went through, and during the Second International period, Marxists thought of LaSalle, who was basically the founder of the other party, the so-called Marxist Party, united with at Gotha. They thought of LaSalle and Marx as co-equal founders of their party. And eventually the influence of Proudhon's ideas waned, but it wasn't because of anything Marx said, in particular anything that he said regarding the economic issues. It was because the character of the French working class had changed. Trying to achieve your goals in a realistic way by using measures that are actually going to get you to the goals versus the realism of doing what seems politically advantageous, that hasn't ever been very popular. But I say, look, we have to speak the truth and seek the truth, and getting things right is its own reward. And it's practically important if we're talking about not only bringing down the old society, but actually creating a new one. You got to get that right. Your ideas got to be right. And also judgments about what's politically advantageous and what's not, they can become passé because of what goes on in the real world, in the objective situation. So because of things like the Paris Commune and the Bolshevik Revolution, Marx eventually became a household name. And Proudhon's name did not, and Dariamon's name did not.
Would you say that this was a defeat for Marx?
What was a defeat for Marx?
The fact that he wasn't able to kick out the LaSallians, and maybe that he wasn't able to make this realistic outlook the dominant one in the socialist organizations.
Yeah, that hasn't happened. That has never taken hold in radical politics. But, like I say, it's absolutely crucial if we actually want to create a new society. Not just bring down the old one, you need to implement measures that will actually accomplish the goal rather than ones that will not. So this thought is necessary despite its lack of popularity.
Is there a sort of scientific principle that revolutionary organizations need to adhere to regarding this realism?
A real problem is the stagification. Let's just do this and that, and then magically, it'll all work out, or other people can worry about that. It's just an abdication of intellectual and moral responsibility.
That's it, I guess.
I just want to thank you for all the time and thought that you've devoted to this, and I think it's been a good discussion. I mean, I got stuff out of it, and hopefully, listeners will have gotten something out of it.
Yeah, well, I'm happy to be here. Hopefully, we'll get to discuss more similar themes.
And that concludes Francisco's March 2nd interview with me on Marx's critique of Dariamon in the Grundrisse. Please visit MHI's website, MarxistHumanistInitiative.org, to listen to other episodes, to learn more about the issues we discuss, to post comments, and to donate to this podcast series. Let me announce again that MHI will be holding a Zoom meeting on the state of the U.S. economy in the year of the general elections. It'll be on Sunday, April 7, 1 to 3 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time in the U.S., 6 to 8 p.m. British Summer Time. It's open to the public. If you'd like to attend, please write to MHI and ask to be invited. This has been episode 113 of Radio Free Humanity, the Marxist Humanist Podcast, coming to you from deep within capitalist society. Thanks for listening, and until next time, goodbye.